We present Beachcomber by the Way, selections from the humour of J.B. Morton, with Richard Ingrams as the author.
Hello, morons.
Interruptions by John Wells as Prodnose.
Well, takes one to know one.
You bastard.
With the considerable talents of Miss June Whitfield, Mr. John Sessions, Miss Joan Sims, Miss Patricia Routledge, Mr. Simon Greenall, Mr. Brian Bowles, and Miss Henrietta Garden. Beachcomber by the Way.
Greetings to you, my public.
And now some news that will gladden the hearts of all men, and quite a few women too, no doubt. Dr. Strabismus, whom God preserve of Utrecht, has invented a new kind of artificial wig, and he proposes...
An artificial wig?
You heard correctly, Al Pellet.
But what can possibly be the use of such a thing? What do you mean by artificial?
Simple. It is not really a wig, it merely looks like one. Hence, by the same reasoning, I often refer to you as Warthog. It is a sham wig.
A sham wig? Well, what's the point of it?
It is intended for people who wish to pretend that they are wearing wigs. Spies, for instance. Or, alternatively, it can be worn by people who are wearing wigs, on top of their first wig, to give the illusion that they are not wearing any wig at all. Of course, if you are both bald and a spy, then the artificial wig would be doubly useful to you.
I'm afraid I still don't understand.
Only a backward oaf could fail to understand. It comes into the same category as dummy glass eyes.
No, I'm not with you.
If only that were not just a figure of speech. Well then, blemish. How about mock false teeth or plastic wooden legs?
You're making those up.
No, no. Here, allow me to show you some artificial imitation leather.
Where is it?
Attached to my boot, Bugweed.
Ah!
That was a real pleasure. And now a small diversion into the ever-popular world of criminal fiction. And by criminal, I refer as much to the oft-times execrable prose to be found in such works as to their subject matter. This story by a new writer, Nollington Faggot, has already been called the most vital and human detective story ever written, proving that a crisp fiver slipped to an unscrupulous literary critic may often turn out to be a wise investment. The plot, such as it is, concerns a rich man living in the country who was not murdered in his library. I repeat, he was not murdered in his library. That is the key to the whole astounding mystery. No wonder it baffled not only the local police, but also the best brains of Scotland Yard. Lucky for them, then, that one of their prize idiots was at hand to solve the case in a matter of hours. The name of this super sleuth is Inspector Jack Malpractice, a name soon to be on the lips of every lover of detective fiction and the shelves of every remaindered bookshop in the land.
We present Dead Man's Alibi, a case for Inspector Jack Malpractice by Nollington Faggot. Part 1, The Missing Body.
Well, here am I, old George Booby, the village constable at Swigney St. Vitus, outside the large country home of Sir Henry Fuzzock at precisely 4 in the morning. I would have made Sergeant yet if it weren't for my eccentric habit of always talking to myself like this. Wait a moment. There's a light shining through the tall French windows of the library. At this hour, that can only mean one thing. Quick, Booby, to the library. Yes, George, at once.
Now, you may be up a class country house guest, but you're going to get out of bed. Come on now. I want everybody out of bed and down here in the hall. Come on, this is the police, isn't that right? Yes, you are. Come on now, line up over there in your expensive negligees and pyjamas, if you would, you two ladies.
Constable, I am Lord Slaver, and I demand to know what is going on here. Haven't been so rudely woken up since Lord Avery tripped over my legs during the reading of the taxes bill. Are we under arrest?
Not exactly, sir, but nobody must leave the premises. Constable Booby's orders. Isn't that right? Yes, it is right.
Why? What has happened?
Aha! Wouldn't you like to know?
Yes, which is why I asked you, you fool.
Ah, well, hear this. There is no corpse in the library.
Well, so what?
Didn't realize it was a legal requirement, that is.
Oh, you won't be so flippant once I've read from my notebook here.
You want to put money on it?
Lights full on in library at 4 a.m. Room empty. No body in ornate chair at desk. No signs of disorder. No blunt instrument.
take cats to vets Tuesday. Oh, no, I ignore that last bit.
Whose body is it that isn't there, Constable?
Good question, Miss...
Trivet. Prunella Trivet.
Miss Trivet, the missing body is that of Sir Henry Fuzzock. This looks like a job for Scotland Yard, doesn't it, Constable? Oh, yes, I'd say you was right there.
Dead Man's Alibi. Still a case for Inspector Jack Malpractice. Part 2, Malpractice Arrives.
Good morning, everybody. I am Malpractice of the Yard. That was my long, low Thanatos 6 sports car you just heard pulling into the drive. Now, who's in charge here?
You are, Inspector.
And don't you forget it, Constable. Now, send the guests back to their rooms and tell them I'll interview them all one by one. Especially the women.
Oh, they've been back there the past half hour, sir.
In that case, Constable, to the library at once before anyone has a chance to return the corpse. Quickly!
Oh, this way, sir. How long here?
Fishy, Booby, very fishy.
Oh, I'm sorry, Inspector, but tin sardines was all I could find in the pantry. I didn't know you'd be expecting sandwiches, did I, George? No, I didn't.
Now then, Booby.
Yes, sir?
The facts are these. Since there is nothing to show that Sir Henry was in here when he was murdered, how do we know he was murdered? Simply because the body isn't here now.
Oh.
It is extremely unlikely that the owner of Swigney Hall would be murdered anywhere but in his library. And if he wasn't here when it happened, why were the lights on? The absence of a blunt instrument is a mere blind to make me think that he was murdered in some other room. Again, why do I assume that it was a blunt instrument? Because I have found no other kind.
Does it not occur to you, Inspector, that the absence of a dead body from a room does not necessarily prove that someone is dead?
Lord Slaver.
For instance, your dead body is not in the kitchen, but you are not dead.
No, but I haven't been feeling very well lately.
Might I suggest to ask Miss Grocer what she was doing in this room at midnight?
Answer that, Booby. It may be Germaine.
No, sir, it's someone called Hilda.
Trace that call.
Yes, sir. Aha, the wire runs from the desk here and into the wall. After that, I'll lose track of it. Do you, Constable? Yes, I do, George.
Damn. We had better talk to this Miss Grocer. You can go now, Lord Slaver.
Oh, we went 5 minutes ago, Inspector.
Blast!
Dead Man's Alibi. Probably the last case for Inspector Malpractice. Part 3, Questions in the Night.
So, you say your name is Hercania Grocer. You're 45 years of age and a spinster.
No, sir, it's George, and I'm married with 3 children.
I wasn't talking to you, Constable. Oh. Go and assemble the guests in the hall ready for my questioning.
Yes, sir.
Now, Miss Grocer, perhaps you could explain exactly what you were doing in the library at midnight,
Borrowing a book, you fool.
A likely story. And did you happen to notice a dead body?
No, but then it was hard to see anything with all the other guests crowded in here.
What, all of them?
Yes.
I assembled the guests for you, Inspector, all 23 of them.
Good man. Now see here, which one of you guests is a filthy foreigner?
I am, Inspector.
But you can't be, you're... beautiful.
Yes. I am Petronilla Belmonte, the beautiful Italian countess. Last night, Sir Henry Fuzzock and I had words. We argued he was insulting. I could have killed him.
Oh. Phew. Signora Belmonte, I'm terribly sorry, but it's my awful duty to charge a creature as beautiful as yourself with murder.
But, Inspector... you are wrong.
God, I hope so.
We all here hate Sir Henry, don't we? And he hates us. So when we move in, he moves out. That is to say, he avoids us. He sleeps in the cellar when the house is full. If we come into a room where he is sitting, he goes out. He was in the library last night, but he went out when we came in. That explains the mystery of the absent body, I think. Sir Henry is probably asleep in the cellar.
Here's the murdered man, sir.
What is all this? Why are all these beasts still clattering up in the hall? Can't you all just clear out? It's daylight now, you know. Can't expect me to stay in that cellar all day. Not now the sabre's run out. Come on, just go and buzz off, will you? The lot of you.
I'm afraid, Inspector, you've had a bit of a wasted journey, hasn't he, Constable? Yes, you're right there, George, he has.
Far from it, Constable Booby. Far from it.
And for once, he was right. As the inspector drove back to Scotland Yard in his long, low sports car, the beautiful Petronilla was by his side.
Despite the denouement, I still maintain that that story was murder. No more for Inspector Malpractice ever again. This seems at least as bad a time as any for more of your personal advertisements.
Will the gentleman who waggled his ears at the lady in the green Macintosh near Euston Station last Tuesday please contact the 9 Happy Nebulos with a view to a music hall engagement?
Josh Cheeserank, Leicester Square, standing room available for 12 cheeses of a moderate girth, 6 pence an hour each.
Wanted by wealthy gentleman, a fishmonger to sell fish at a concert as a kind of joke. All fish supplied, bring own apron and state size of slab required.
Nudist Thespians will produce the nudist version of Hamlet at the Old Barn, Bogglesham, next Thursday.
Society lady would sell enormous red wig, part worn, suitable for bald giantess or judge of high court. Could be used as child's bath mat.
Experienced conjurer, 6 post as butler valet, would produce a bent egg from soft hat or goldfish from clear soup.
Colonel Sir Arthur Wilmot Worcester did not, I repeat, did not invent the famous sauce. Journalists, please note.
Quite so. Honourable newsmen should never reveal their sources. Ha ha ha. Let us hurry on before Prudnose turns uglier. I was proud and happy to read in a criticism of a recent concert that there was a remarkable spirit of friendship between conductor and orchestra. Remarkable is the operative word. Usually they loathe each other. Dirty looks are exchanged, things are thrown, curse words are bandied to and fro, and sometimes the conductor, outnumbered, has to take to his heels, pursued by a mob of maddened players. Where there is friendship between conductor and orchestra, it is usually manifested by little smiles and bows, kindly shouts of encouragements and hand clasps. Indeed, I have seen a trombonist so moved by the conductor's shout of "Well played, old chap," that he has run across the dais with outstretched hand, crying, "Put it there, chum," while the orchestra, abandoning Beethoven or whatnot, has crashed into the opening bars of "Dear Old Pals." Again, I have seen a conductor trying to regulate Dvorak's Scherzo Capriccioso with a cellist linking one arm and an oboist the other, whilst 2 supernumerary horn players stood behind, patting his back vigorously. Is it any wonder that in such a convivial atmosphere many a practical joke is played?
The lights are low, a hush of expectation grips the tense audience with what a shock. They see the great conductor raise his baton and suck it, crying, "'Tis but Worthing Rock." Their eyes they cannot draw from this confection, and in due reverence each person sits to see the great conductor tap the rostrum and see his baton shatter into bits.
The same piece of music criticism goes on to say that the patience of the cellos and basses was noticeable as they waited for their moment in the first movement. As a general rule, they dash in, 14 or 15 bars ahead of their time, and reduce the whole affair to chaos.
The best way to avoid this is to tie their arms and legs to their seats with strong, tarry twine. When their moment approaches, get a commissionaire to enter unobtrusively and undo the knots. Great care, however, must be taken not to make the knots too difficult to untie. I have heard a distraught commissionaire bellowing for a knife from any lady or gentleman in the audience in the middle of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. Indeed, several of the more sophisticated concert-goers mistook the raucous calls for grand opera and stood and applauded loudly when the commissionaire, shamefaced, finally left the hall. To this day, he still breaks spontaneously into a cold sweat when he hears the phrase, "get knotted."
Life at Bolton Wingfevers. The Memoirs of a Serving Man by Travers, Butler to the Peerage.
Hello. My master, Lord Shortcake, the 17th lord of that name, and occupier of the commodious Tudor residence of Bolton Wingfevers, was a man of multitudinous hobbies, each of which he pursued with a zeal verging on monomania. Lord Shortcake's one continuing passion was an interest in goldfish. Lady Shortcake, though not sharing her husband's passion for goldfish, was a handsome and stately lady of the old world. Her main interest was her rose garden, but there came a clash when a variety of rose was called after her. Lord Shortcake had already named a breed of goldfish in her honour and was worried that the two might become confused.
You must ask for the name to be changed, Connie.
Nonsense, Shorty! How on earth could anyone mistake flowers for fish?
Well, both are kept indoors in water, my love. Indeed, a rose bowl and a goldfish bowl might be considered identical, but for their occupants. Not to mention the anemone, which is both a fly and a fish. Well, not a fish exactly.
Very well, Shorty, you win. I shall write to the authorities.
Thank you, my love, but it is a victory for the fish, not for me.
The bloom in question is now called Mrs. Huffnagel. Lady Shortcake was also deeply interested in folk dancing and sponsored a village troupe drawn largely from the staff at Bolton Wingfevers. The only time my master became aware of this was when, returning one early spring morning from bird-watching on the banks of the Bottlemere and about to let himself in by the back door, he ran into Angelica, one of the parlour-maids. She was dressed up as Queen of the May, and Lord Shortcake asked for an explanation.
Upon my word! Angelica, what is this, fancy dress?
On being told that she was on her way to the Maypole, he thought she was referring to a local inn.
Angelica, I'm surprised at you. How long have you had this dreadful habit?
Since last year, if you please, Lord Shortcake, sir.
Really?
But I only begun it because her ladyship told me to. Honest, sir.
What? Astonishing. I shall speak to my wife about this, Angelica.
Yes, sir. Good day, sir.
I'll call you, my dear.
Don't speak with your mouth full, Shorty.
I'm sorry, my love, but I met Angelica this morning, going to the Maypole. She had the impudence to say you had told her to do it.
Of course she's one of my most promising pupils.
Pupils? Am I mad? Since when have you been given lessons in drinking?
Who said anything about drinking?
Well, what else is there to do at the Maypole?
They dance round it, you oaf.
But what?
Shorty, did you take a hip flask with you for bird watching?
No, my love. But I jolly well wish I had.
My master continued his meal in a brooding silence until the arrival of the boiled eggs, at which point his mood lightened considerably. Lord Shortcake was most partial to a plain boiled egg and kept the shells, which he used to make what he jestingly called
a small porcelain bric-a-brac, what?
These were so fragile that no maid was allowed to dust them. One ornament was in the form of a miniature frigate, with matches for the masts and calico for the sails, and he was most upset when one day it disintegrated during his bath and disappeared with the bathwater.
Oh, I suppose I should have gone down with it.
In addition to eggshell sculpture and goldfish keeping, my master also collected stamps, but only English twopenny stamps. He had no interest in foreign stamps, which, he said, should be left to foreigners, and filled album after album with the common tuppennies in his firm belief that no two stamps were the same. It was the duty of my master's secretary, Aubyn Spicecraft, to keep every tuppenny stamp which arrived with each day's post.
How many of our well-known tuppennies today, Spicecraft?
13 today, your lordship.
13? Oh, good, good. Lucky for me, Spicecraft. Put them in the album, will you? I'd like to look at them later.
Yes, Lord Shortcake. But look, there's a letter here from your sister who says she's had another debilitating attack of gout. I really think
well,
that...
Well, what odds, so long as it's got the jolly old tuppenny stuck to it, eh, Spicer? Give me the stamp, I always say, and anybody can have the letter, eh?
Yes, your lordship, you do always say that.
Jolly good. Pass me the boiled eggs. I think I feel a galleon coming on.
Lord Shortcake's widowed sister, Lady Bursting, was a frequent visitor. She had had a singing mouse given to her by a friend, and we had to be very careful of it. It was fed on the choicest morsels of cheese, which so amused my master that one night he gave it some port.
This should stop it squeaking, eh, Travers?
Indeed, your lordship. That night, the singing was distinctly husky and out of tune, and when put out for its run before being shut up for the night, the mouse staggered along the terrace and finally fell down the steps into the rose garden.
I'm sorry, Henrietta, my dear. How did I know it couldn't hold its liquor? Listen, I've written an epitaph to cheer us all up. I'll begin, shall I? Alas, for Henrietta's mouse, it was the pet of everyone in the house. But the cat pounced like a couple of retrievers, and that was the end of the pride of Bolton Winfever. There, what do you think?
Shorty, I think your stamps need attending to.
No, I don't think they do, my love.
Shorty!
Yes, Connie, my dear.
There, Henrietta. I'm sure he didn't mean it. He's been overdoing the hobbies. The doctor said it wouldn't be good for him. If only I could think of some other way of keeping him busy.
By a happy coincidence, the local member of Parliament for the constituency had just died. Or rather, it was a tragic coincidence. Anyway, Lady Shortcake encouraged my master to stand in the by-election in the hope that the slow pace of Shire County politics would prove conducive to Lord Shortcake's health. Unaware of this subterfuge, my master went along with the idea, but was at a loss to decide what interest to represent. He therefore sought the advice of his sponsor, Mr. Bugloss, a go-ahead member of the local football team.
Any ideas, Bugloss?
Why not promote yourself as the goldfish candidate?
The goldfish candidate?
Yeah. Yes, yes, animals always go down well with the voters. Better treatment for our dumb friends and all that, eh?
Goldfish, Bugloss, are not dumb.
Well, you can't say they're clever, Lord Shortcake.
They mew very faintly during certain seasons. I speak from experience here.
Yes, Lord Shortcake.
Other than that, Bugloss, I am more than prepared to present to the electorate the case for better treatment for all fish. So let's get to it, eh? Rights for goldfish.
Some weeks later, Lady Shortcake was arranging a dozen Mrs. Huffnagels in a bowl in the East Wing when my master's secretary, Aubyn Spicecraft, approached bearing a sheaf of important-looking documents.
Ah, there you are, Lady Shortcake. I've brought the necessary forms for you to sign. A mere formality.
Forms, Spicecraft? What forms?
The forms declaring his lordship's renunciation of his peerage. Hereditary peers cannot, as you know, sit in the House of Commons. You need to countersign these to show your agreement to becoming plain Mrs. Shortcake. Yes, you'll be plebeian in no time. Still, if it's in the interests of the future Mr. Shortcake's health...
Excuse me, Spicecraft. Shorty? Shorty? Shorty?
Well, that was easier than I thought. Who wants to be secretary to a commoner?
Shorty, oh, put down that pen. You must cease your campaigning at once.
What? But why, my dear? The goldfish need me.
Why? Because, Shorty... If you get up in the house and talk about goldfish, you will be laughed at.
Laughed at?
Yes, of course, Shorty. Though heaven knows they show the gravest respect for the most errant nonsense when it suits them.
Through me, they would be laughing at the fish, and that would not do. Perhaps I can best serve the interests of fish by abstaining from the rostrum of public life, eh?
Yes, thank God. I mean, a wise decision.
The by-election was later won by Sir Arnold Thrax, the independent canary fancier's candidate. And so life returned to what passed for normal at Bolton Wynfever's, and her ladyship from that day on indulged my master's many hobbies with a knowing smile and a sigh of relief at a tragedy avoided. Ah, they were happy days, days as golden as my master's beloved fish, and ones I shall never forget. Till the next time...
Still typing?
Oh, Prudnose, what a sad thing it is.
Yes, the end of another series.
I was referring to your Fizzog Gargoyle. But since you happened to mention it, yes, the end of this series, and indeed with it, the end of my dictionary for today.
Oh, so there is some good news after all.
Hush, homunculus, and savour these final moments of lexicographical splendour.
All right, let's get it over with then.
We begin with you, for unassuming... Any non-entity in the public eye about whom there is nothing to say is called unassuming.
Bosh.
Unsurpassed. Any politician's knowledge of anything he talks about is said to be unsurpassed.
What all?
V for vagabond. Word used by newspaper diarists to describe any man who has enough money to spend his time travelling all over the world in pursuit of pleasure.
Gaff.
Vigil. Waiting overnight in the queue for the start of the Harrods sale. Vivid. When a novelist produces a work in which the characters all talk like drunken bargees, the book is called A Vivid Picture of Life as It Is.
Clap, clap.
W for warning. When a motor car is travelling so fast that it cannot pull up quickly enough to avoid knocking down a pedestrian, the horn is blown. This is called a warning.
Piffle.
Wedding, secret. A wedding that is reported more widely and at greater length than other weddings.
Hogwash.
And lastly, witticism. Any joke, whether stale or fresh, funny or dull, made by any person currently in the public eye. There, that's it. The end.
What? But it can't be. You haven't finished the alphabet.
Of course not. This is my dictionary for today, and nobody gets today what they could have taken for granted in the past. It is my final comment on the modern way of things.
My final comment is, it is you being a cheapskate.
Wrong as always, Weasel. Your final comment is a dull question followed by a penetrating falsetto squeal.
What do you mean?
Ah, I shall miss that most enjoyable exercise. Till we meet again, goodbye, my public, goodbye.
That was Beachcomber by the Way, adapted for radio by Michael Barfield, with Richard Ingrams, who appeared as Beachcomber. John Wells, June Whitfield, John Sessions, Joan Sims, Patricia Routledge, Simon Greenall, Brian Bowles, and Henrietta Garden played the other characters. Your announcer was Perkins, and the producer was Thompson.